The Financial Sense News Hour with Jim Poflava continues, featuring uncommon news for the wise investor. Up next, commentary and debate about today's financial issues with the experts. Here's Jim Poflava.
My special guest this week is F. William Engdahl. He's written on issues of energy, politics, and economics for more than 30 years, beginning with the first oil shock in the early 70s. He's contributed regularly to a number of publications, including Japan's Shimbun, Foresight Magazine, Grant's Interest Investor, European Banker, and Business Banker International. He's spoken at numerous international conferences on geopolitical, economic, and energy subjects. His new book is called A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order. Mr. Engdahl, at the end of the Cold War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was hailed as the sort of dawn of a new era. Francis Fukuyama proclaimed it as the beginning of the end of history. Instead of peace, we've seen conflict. Now the U.S. is at war. It isn't a conventional war, but nonetheless a war. The war is about oil, but also it is a war about full-spectrum dominance. Explain.
This full-spectrum dominance, Jim, is a Pentagon term, one of the lovely expressions that they like to throw out to obfuscate what they're doing. But I think if we step back a little bit and look at what the end of the Cold War was all about, in historical perspective, we basically had a huge chunk of this planet that suddenly, after about 70 years, and certainly after 1945, was open for the first time to Western banking, Western capital relations, if you want to call it that. And the message of, well, George Bush Sr. at that time was president in the Houston, Texas G7 Economic Summit was in 1990, in June of 1990, he basically told the other members of the Group of Seven, the French, the Germans, the Italians, and so forth, that the International Monetary Fund was going to call the shots in terms of restructuring the former Soviet economies. Now, that was very calculated on the part of Washington, because what they did was to apply an economic shock therapy that told the Russians essentially overnight, from day one to day two, you have to become a, quote, market economy. What that meant was not just a plundering of the assets of this huge land, Russia, the largest land expanse of any country in the world, but access to the raw materials in dollar terms was what emerged, and that was the whole purpose of the Clinton-Russian policy, to get the to get their hands on the oil and gas assets, as well as the aluminum and the other magnesium and the other commodities that Russia is so rich in. So the end of the Cold War was really the opening of a whole part of this world to rather crude, I don't know a better word for it, exploitation by certain Western companies that that took what they could at bargain basement prices.
Now, U.S. hedge money, like British hedge money, in one sense, rests on two pillars, the uncontested military power of the United States, and the second pillar is the uncontested role of the dollar as the world's reserve currency.
Right.
How long can we maintain that position? In other words, as the U.S. becomes more debt-ridden, much in the same way that Britain did at the turn of the century, and also as other powers start rearming, we almost find ourselves alone in some sense. And on the other hand, how long can we maintain the value of the dollar?
A very good question, Jim. I ask myself this almost every morning when I get up and look at the latest developments in financial markets and with the dollar and so forth, especially with oil topping $68 a barrel today. The basic premise on which the, just as you mentioned, the American hegemony has been built in the post-war period is the dollar as reserve currency. And that covers a multitude of sins, and the role of the U.S. as the unchallenged military superpower on this planet. Now, the military role in recent years has dominated over the economic role, I think especially since the European Union back at the end of the 90s launched their euro single currency, and for the first time in the post-war period actually presented a theoretical potential challenge to the hegemony of the U.S. dollar as reserve currency. to date, the Europeans haven't gotten their act together. The United States, Washington, has played on that in a classic balance of power, divide and conquer strategy by trying to pit the British against the French, the Poles against the Germans, the Spanish, and so forth, especially around the Iraq War. But the Europeans haven't gotten a coherent strategy to counter the throw weight of the U.S. military force projection globally, and the role of the dollar as reserve currency remains. The question really is how long countries such as China and, well, Japan is a special case because of the post-war military defense relation between Washington and Tokyo. But leaving Japan aside, how long will China accumulate dollar reserves and look at their investments simply propping up the U.S. indebtedness and the U.S. oil wars in the Middle East that are, or theoretically, actually taking future oil reserves from the Chinese economy? So that's an open question, and I can't give you a specific date, but I think it's a highly precarious geopolitical situation that Washington is developed for itself in the last 10, 15 years.
Many nations depend on American markets for trade, for selling their goods as the largest consumer market in the world. And many of these nations depend on American military power for security, for example,
sure.
Japan.
Yeah.
But this relationship is changing today. As you look at Japanese trade, the trade with China is building up while the trade with the U.S. has been in decline.
Yeah.
So doesn't this change the balance of power to some extent?
Most definitely. This is the number one question behind the doors in the planning rooms of the Pentagon, in the planning rooms of the State Department, in the White House, and elsewhere. This is really the emergence of China as a strategic counterweight to the not only the economic power, but the political power of the United States. And the Chinese have been very, very shrewd, and I'd say rather cautious since the Iraq War in 2003, in how they have played their cards vis-a-vis the relationship with Washington. But I think if we look at the kind of thing that I describe in the book, In the Century of War, about the emergence of the United States around the time between World War One and World War Two, the end of 1945, as the dominant superpower, the hegemonic power on this planet, assuming the role that the British Empire had played for a century since the end of the Napoleonic Wars in the early 1800s, that was an epochal change. That was a profound phase change in world geopolitics. And I think we are coming into precisely that kind of epochal change or phase change in global geopolitics. In fact, we're in it right now. And that is the emergence of a China-centered Asia. The role that Japan plays vis-a-vis China, I think, is an open question still. I think the Chinese elites are split on that. The business elites are very, very, as you pointed out, are very locked into dependence on Chinese low-cost labor and production processes. So it's becoming for Japan a very complicated thing to balance their Washington relation along with their growing involvement with China economically.
You know, one thing about U.S. military power and the power of the dollar, most people don't realize how the dollar and military power are intertwined with one commodity, and that is oil.
Yeah, yes. That's a good part of the actual story that I tell in the book, and that is the military power projection of the United States. If you look at just look at the post-war period alone. The whole role of U.S. force projection in the Middle East has to do with one country in particular, that is Saudi Arabia, the largest oil producer until today, with Russia giving it a good run for its money, but Saudi Arabia still remains the largest producer, although there's very serious doubt as to whether the Saudis are giving honest numbers on their production these days. Perhaps we can talk about that later. So what's quite fascinating to me, looking at the geopolitics of U.S. policy since the end of the Cold War, is U.S. military power projection in what people like Zbigniew Brzezinski and strategists in Washington call Eurasia. Eurasia is simply Europe and Asia as a landmass. If you simply look at a globe or look at a map of the globe, you see that it's one contiguous landmass from China across Russia into Western Europe, and that's called Eurasia by geographers. The British, back in since 1904, have been very much focused on the control of Eurasia through British naval policy up until 1945, when the British essentially emerged as a bankrupt empire to be bought out on the cheap by Washington, by the U.S. Look at the various military engagements that the U.S. has had since the end of the Cold War, and in almost every single one of them, the dollar and oil play a strategic role. Afghanistan, the whole pipeline politics for oil and natural gas going through Afghanistan, down into India and various other places. The role of the United States in the Kosovo War in 1999, the Clinton administration, the first NATO out-of-area deployment, actually a violation of the NATO Charter, but those legal niceties are often these days simply ignored in the waste bin of history. The Kosovo deployment allowed the United States to build something called Camp Bondsteel. And Camp Bondsteel is a state-of-the-art, one of the largest military fortresses that the United States has in the world today. That allows the United States to position itself such that it can control potential pipeline flows coming from Russia, coming from the Black Sea, and so forth, into Western Europe or into various ports that would bring it out into the world market. I think the basic driver of U.S. foreign policy in recent years has been to militarily position itself to control essentially every single major source of petroleum that is known to exist on the planet, and that, in addition to that, to control the major oil choke points. You know, you have these channels like the Straits of Hormuz. You have the Straits of Malacca going through the narrow passageway between Indonesia and Burma, or today it's called Myanmar. That brings most of the crude oil tanker flows from the Persian Gulf around into China and Japan. So the United States has been doing little pinprick actions to try to position itself in that part of the world militarily. So far, it hasn't succeeded. The Chinese and the East Asians, the Southeast Asian countries, have been very adamant, Malaysia especially, about not having U.S. naval presence in that area for obvious reasons. But if you look at the politics in Iraq, this catastrophic situation from the standpoint of U.S. policy, in Iraq, it's just been announced that there are four major permanent military bases, U.S. bases, that are being completed in Iraq, and while there may be public talk about a few soldiers going home, the U.S. is creating like a Guantanamo, but Mach 4 Guantanamo, four huge bases in Iraq for permanent military presence. Another recent innovation has been creation of an air base in Principe and San Tome, which are islands just off of the oil-rich regions of Angola and West Africa. So the U.S. military very much not just follows the flag, it follows the oil these days in American foreign policy.
Well, you know, no other element has shaped history in the last century as the fight to secure and control the world's reserves of petroleum. Much of your book is this Anglo-American alliance and also about history, because before the Americans, there were the British. I wonder if you might discuss the three pillars of the British Empire: the control of the seas, as we do today, international banking, and geopolitical domination of the world's raw materials.
Right. Basically, as you pointed out, the British Empire was extraordinarily successful in the period up until about the end of the 1800s, the 1890s, I would say. They had a run of almost a century, and they dominated. They were rather cocky about it toward the end, toward the outbreak of World War I. The expression was, the sun never sets on the British Empire. In reality, what was happening was that the pillars of the British Empire were beginning to rot out from under them. The the finance, the City of London finance and the gold standard was simply not able to extract the rates of profit from places like Argentina, where they had a huge bankruptcy that Barings Bank was involved in the 1890s. England went through a Great Depression. It's something that most people today don't even realize, but they went through from 1873 to 1890s, rather, excuse me. They went through a deep, deep economic depression because of their economic strategy at that point. So coming into the First World War, what was called then the Great War, the financial pillar of the City of London was extremely shaky, although no one talked about it publicly. I researched in preparing the book, I researched certain archival documents from the British Finance Ministry that have since been released into the public domain. And they basically show that the British government was bankrupt on the eve of World War I, 1914. The raw materials, well, there the British were very foresighted. Winston Churchill, as a young naval man at that time, and Jack Fisher, the Lord of the Admiralty, they were foresighted enough to realize that oil was the energy source that would create a revolution in transportation, in the reach of a navy and so forth. The first navy to convert into oil-fired ships would have a strategic advantage unparalleled. So British geopolitics began at the turn of the century, began orienting itself on control of world known oil regions. Well, in the United States, you had John D. Rockefeller and the Standard Oil Trust, which was at the same time beginning to poke its head out of the United States and look around the world for just the same thing, how Standard Oil could control the world oil resources. So the raw materials, World War One was very much about busting up the old Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Reich, and dismantling it in order that the British could take the richest oil lands in Persia, Iran today, in Iraq, then called Mesopotamia, in Kuwait, which the British essentially swindled out from under the Ottoman Reich in 1899 with a 100-year agreement that nobody would do business with Kuwait except the British. That was rather a cute thing. So they began to try to secure the raw materials of the future. But the problem for the British was that the financial pillar was really crumbling out from under them. And in a sense, what you can see is the period between 1914, let's say, and 1945 was an unresolved struggle over who would be the successor empire or the successor hegemon, the successor power, global power, to the crumbling British Empire. And there were two contenders at the turn of the century in 1900 or so. The one was the enormous industrial expansion of Germany on the continent. Germany had an education system unparalleled in the world at that time. They had an industrial steel industry, chemical industry. I mean, the patents, the inventions, they were coming out of Germany like no other place. And the British were astonished by this. They had not expected such a colossal growth. This is in certain ways similar, perhaps, to the rapid expansion of China on the economic front in the last 10 years. But the United States saw this very much as well. And the United States Washington policy, or the policy of the, let's call it the New York establishment or the East Coast establishment, which essentially in that time boiled down to the oil interest and the New York banks, such as National City, such as Chase Bank of the Rockefeller Group and so forth, J.P. Morgan, of course, they said we have a chance to get in on the game of empire here by becoming the banker to the bankrupt British. They financed all the British military expenses during World War One. At the end of the war, they said, excuse me, Britain, you've got to pay back your debts here. So that was the beginning of a struggle which took until 1945 to resolve itself, and that was what Henry Luce called the American century, emergence of the American colossus or the American hegemony. That now is, to my mind, on equally shaky legs as the British were 1914.
How did oil become the weapon in the Middle East, the battleground during World War One? And number two, what made the decision to go to the war for the British remarkable in my mind was England was essentially bankrupt at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have two questions here. As I just mentioned, the British Treasury was essentially unable to finance a war. It was simply, there was a confidential memo sent to the Prime Minister at the outbreak of war that essentially they were bankrupt. So, and as I pointed out, J.P. Morgan was the one who filled the gap and did so with a very calculated intent, and that was that Washington would dictate the terms of the post-war Versailles so-called peace negotiations and play a role in carving up Europe and the rest of the world. Well, the British weren't quite willing to step down from the center stage at that point, so there was a very, very bitter kind of hidden war that went on over the size of naval fleets, and it almost, according to some British friends of mine, it almost came to a shooting war between Washington and Britain in the 1920s. The role of oil, it was one of the diagrams I have in the book, is something that I found from a magazine called the London Petroleum Review, and this was in May of 1914, the London Petroleum Review, and they show a picture of the route of a German rail project that today is almost unknown, even in Germany. It was called at that time the Berlin-Baghdad Railway. Very interesting in light of the history of Iraq up to the present. And the German idea was to build a railway from Berlin, i.e. the heart of continental Europe, to link through trade, link all the way down to Baghdad and ultimately down to the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf, that could then bring trade from India or the Indian subcontinent up through by land connection direct into continental Europe. Now, that was a strategic threat to the power of the Royal Navy, the British military control of the water and the Suez Canal, because the Germans essentially were outflanking by going by land over the Balkans and into Turkey and down through into down into Baghdad, and the rail line was already finished. Well, the London Petroleum Review in May of 1914 has a picture of a petroleum map of Mesopotamia, and they show that the great oil fields of Kirkuk, the great oil fields of Mosul, and so forth, that today are the site of so much contention, they were already well known at that time to be huge reserves of petroleum. So that was extremely provocative to the British, that the continental Europeans would try to become potentially economically independent from the British Imperial Navy.
Now, by the end of the war, oil had emerged as a key success in the revolution in military strategy. If you take a look at, in World War One, the introduction of the airplane in terms of air warfare, tanks, naval warfare, it really became an essential ingredient in the ability of a country to wage war, and we saw that play out once again in World War Two, and we've seen it play out throughout most of the wars of the 20th century.
Definitely, most definitely. Yeah, the crucial thing about oil and why it's so alarming right now, the reports of the depletion of the great oil finds of the last 30 to 40 years, in some cases the last 50 years, the entire transport economy of the world is dependent on petroleum as its driving fuel. So, and the military force projections, naval and otherwise, of course, now you have nuclear-powered submarines, but or nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, but the role of petroleum in driving, for example, World War II, the German tanks were essentially ground to a halt by the fact that the British and the Americans were able to cut off their oil access through Romania, and the whole campaign, the whole desert campaign of the Germans, Rommel, the Desert Fox, so-called, in northern Africa, was to cut the British off from their oil lifeline in the Middle East, in Mesopotamia and the Middle East. and it almost succeeded. Had that happened, that would have been quite another play out of history in the post-war period. But at the last minute, it didn't happen. But that's simply a very telling example of how vital oil was in all these wars.
Why don't you take us through from World War One, World War Two, and how this power balance changed eventually with Americans replacing the British. We had, after World War II, Britain was essentially like World War One. It was bankrupt. It didn't have the capability of maintaining its military around the empire. We had the Suez Crisis.
Right.
We had a series of devaluations of the British currency. So a couple things started to happen. Number one, economically, they just didn't have the money to do it anymore. And number two, their currency obviously did not give them the strength and the means to do what they did when they were an empire in the 19th century. And I want to bring that parallel to where the U.S. finds itself today.
Right. It is a very real parallel. It's good you point that out, Jim. The British, after 1945, essentially had exhausted themselves in every shape in every way, shape, and form. They had depended on American government largesse in the form of lend-lease, and after the war, when the Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes for the British Treasury, and Harry Dexter White for the U.S. Treasury, they were the main negotiators of the Bretton Woods agreements, which established the World Bank, or the International Bank for Reconstruction, it was called then, and the International Monetary Fund. The idea that the British had was that this structure would allow a rebuilding of the world economy, especially the European economy, and a revitalization of the British Empire through sterling preferences with the Commonwealth countries such as Australia, Canada, and so forth. And the view in New York and among the banks and the view in Washington in the Treasury was that the United States wasn't about to put Britain back on its feet. Now, some naive historians have taken this as a sign that Franklin Roosevelt and Truman were anti-colonial. No, I think that's a fallacy of composition. Washington wasn't anti-colonial. They were anti-British colonial. They were anti-French colonial, anti-Dutch colonial. And the so-called support for the anti-colonial movement in Africa and Asia, places like Indonesia, was simply to disrupt the imperial control of Britain over its colonies and open those countries, open those raw materials for access by preferred American corporations, just like Halliburton has a preferred access in Iraq today.
If you take a look at what happened after World War II, we set up the Bretton Woods system, and what emerged is three pillars for the U.S., the IMF, the World Bank, and GATT. I wonder if you might go over that and how that played in supporting America's position and achieving its political aims.
I think at the early part of the post-war period, I'd add the Marshall Plan to that because, well, first let's take a look at the Bretton Woods system, 1945. The United States or Washington set it up such that there was not a gold standard, but a gold exchange standard. This is a very critical qualification, Jim. The gold exchange standard post-war was that all currencies would peg to the United States dollar, the French franc, the Italian lira, the British pound, etc. And the American dollar was the only currency that would peg to gold. So, and the premise was, since the United States in 1945 had more than the lion's share of all the gold reserves of the world central banks through the experiences of the war period and also the lending, the U.S. was very diligent about taking gold as collateral for its dollar loans to the Europeans during the war. The United States emerged with the lion's share of world monetary gold, the dollar pegged to that monetary gold, and all the other currencies hungry to get dollars as the only hard currency in the post-war period. So the situation worked up until the late 60s when de Gaulle and the French and a few of the Europeans, including the Germans, began to yell and scream that the United States was running huge balance of trade, huge. You have to laugh in the comparison with what George W. Bush has managed to accomplish today. But in those days' terms, the U.S. was running huge balance of trade and budget deficits because of the cost of the Vietnam War, and essentially de Gaulle and the French argued that Jacques Rouef, de Gaulle's brilliant financial advisor, they argued that was able to finance the war by exporting inflation to the Europeans, which in a real sense was true. Well, it's what Washington is doing today in tenfold over, only the difference is, and this is a crucial difference, since August 1971, Jim, as you know, the dollar is no longer pegged to gold. Back in the 60s, there were a series of claims by European central banks to redeem their dollars for real solid gold, monetary gold, from the vaults of Fort Knox or wherever it was stashed. And that led to a 1967 run on the gold reserves of the U.S. and of England, the collapse of sterling, the first major currency in the Bretton Woods system to collapse in November 1967. And sterling was forced to devalue, and then everybody turned their attention to the dollar as the next domino to fall. And the pressure built up until August 71 when Nixon, on advice from his Treasury people, which included, interesting enough, not only John Conley, I think, who was Treasury Secretary then, but Paul Volcker, who was an assistant Treasury Secretary, and they advised that Nixon simply shut the dollar discount window of the New York Federal Reserve and tell the Europeans, sorry boys, we're tearing up Bretton Woods and going our own way. And that's basically what happened. So what happened after that is colossal. You had a monetary inflation the likes of which the world has never seen. If you go back to 1971 and look at the dollars in circulation worldwide, the rate of growth of dollars in circulation, and compare that with the period of 1950 to 1970, approximately. 1950 to 70, that 20-year span, you had on the order of a 55% increase over 20 years, a total of 55% increase in dollar reserves extant in the world. In the period 71 to approximately 2000 or 2001, I don't have the figure in front of me, you had a 2,500% increase in dollars in circulation. Little wonder that in real terms most people feel when they slam the door of a car nowadays, at least an American car, you feel that the steel content has become a little bit more shaky and the paper content has become highly inflated. So that has created a situation, this break from the gold standard and the kinds of checks and balances that a classical gold standard would force Washington to follow in terms of deficits and trade policy. That is simply gone, and that's created a unprecedented situation compounded by the fact that the U.S. consciously uses its military full-spectrum dominance or force projection to enforce its role as the reserve currency.
If we take a look at what happened to Britain, it was decaying internally before it got to World War One. You have a turning point in your book where you mention in 1957 the beginning of the internal decay in the United States. Explain that.
Well, I really grew up through this period, and it's very real to me. The 56-57 recession was kind of the warning signal that the basis on which the United States economy and the dollar had been able to flourish all through the post-war period, essentially from the late 40s into the 57 period, that had exhausted itself. The investment in plant and equipment, you had a huge government-subsidized creation of entire industries, such as aluminum out in the West Coast for the aircraft construction. A number of these things created a huge industrial base that the U.S. could expand on after the war, the chemical industry, the fertilizer industry, things like this. 1957 recession essentially was a signal that a fundamental new investment had to take place internally in plant and equipment from American factories and the steel industry and so forth, and essentially in government economic policy. 57 was also the famous year, and I remember this from my high school days, of the Sputnik shock. Sputnik, for those of your listeners who might not remember, was of course the Russian space success, and they put this satellite up in space well before the U.S. did. And at that point, Eisenhower was president, and he said, we have to revitalize American higher education because the Russians are turning out better mathematicians and physicists and chemists than we are, obviously. So there were some feeble attempts to try to revitalize the education, but that really didn't get traction into the 60s. And what happened instead was a beginning of U.S. corporations going overseas, going into Europe to buy on the cheap through the great M&A wave, mergers and acquisitions of European companies, instead of rethinking their own strategies back home. And then, of course, in the 60s, you have the buildup of this debacle in Vietnam, which was a national crisis of the first order by the end of the 60s. But you had this abandonment, conscious policy of economic abandonment of entire industrial regions of the Middle West, Pittsburgh, from Boston down through New York, Long Island, and so forth, that the whole cities, Chicago and so forth, the industrial heartland of America was beginning to rot internally. Its cities were turning into ghettos that were going up in flames throughout the 60s. So rather than address that in a sober way, in a real way, solutions were taken by let's call it the East Coast establishment, which simply maximized their profits abroad, and they simply walked away from responsibility back home and began developing things such as the Eurodollar market back in the 60s to do that, with offshore tax havens and the whole nine yards.
Why did the Americans embark down the same failed policies of the British? I mean, if you can look back historically and see how Britain embarked down the same road, we almost copied and followed in a similar fashion. I mean, didn't we look back and say, boy, if we go down this road, if we deindustrialize, you know, we are consuming our seed corn here in the United States very much today. We consume more than we produce. You can't maintain an empire that way because you weaken and you rot internally.
Well, interesting, just that point, Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary of State and very controversial Secretary of State during the Nixon era and into the Gerald Ford presidency. Kissinger made an address, and I got a copy of this in Danish from a Danish banker friend of mine over here. He made an address to the annual conference of a major computer company, a major software company in Las Vegas 2 years ago in the summer. And he actually warned, he said, when an elite loses the loyalty of its upper middle class because they're no longer able to get productive, flourishing jobs and no longer able to live the living standard of upper middle class people, then the entire stability of an elite is threatened. And we are at a dangerous proximity to that point today, Kissinger warned. He said the outsourcing of 100, 150,000 a year software engineering and IT jobs to Bangalore and other places in India. Now they're going to Romania, to Russia, Ukraine, and so forth. He warned that was a trend which had ominous implications for the future of the U.S., and I think that trend is, if anything, accelerated since Kissinger made that warning 2 years ago. And it is. It's in many ways very, very much the same road of ruin that the British followed previously. I think the thing that gives certain people in Washington and New York a sense of cockiness about this, they've simply broken from the gold standard. And Herman Kahn at the Hudson Institute said to a friend of mine who was a young economist at the time, we Americans discovered something that the British never figured out. If we abandon the gold standard, and as long as we're the military number one, we can carry on creating dollar debt indefinitely, and the world will have to swallow our debt. So that is the mentality, and I think that's a, what did the French say, après moi la déluge, after me let the floods come, kind of mentality. And it's like Marie Antoinette saying, let them eat cake, is the French Revolution when the mobs are beginning to crowd the palace. And I often have this sense of what Yogi Berra calls deja vu all over again when I see some of these things play out and look at it from a sense of history.
If we look at where we are today, we have trade deficits that are over $700 billion.
No, it's staggering. It's just unbelievable, isn't it?
And then we have budget deficits that, you know, you've got to take almost two sets of books. You have the official budget deficit, and then you have the off-budget deficit. And,
right.
You know, we've got a drug prescription bill that will kick in the next year or two. We have baby boomers hitting the Social Security system around 2008. We have the Iraq War. Now we have the rebuilding of New Orleans that's going to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 billion. I think it's somebody once said Washington is the only place in the world where they can't distinguish the difference between a million and a billion.
Or a trillion.
Now we're talking about trillions. How do we force all of that debt onto the rest of the world at a time that, you know, we're absorbing all the world's savings? We have no savings ourselves. These numbers keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Do we reach the point where they say no mas?
I think there's several options, and I think some people in the Pentagon are very conscious of this, and one of them is I hate to say it, but is a military solution to this. And in times of war, you can do a lot of writing off of worthless debts. The British did it repeatedly through their history, and I think we're coming to a very, very dangerous period unless some people start coming to their senses in the U.S. policy circles about what the implications are of this madness.
I think we've almost are getting to the point where we're going to inflate our way out of this, because I simply don't see, with the national debt at $8 trillion and as a country over $40 trillion, we've got nearly $50 trillion of unfunded pension, Social Security, and Medicare liabilities.
Right.
We're rebuilding New Orleans. Who knows? We may rebuild Houston, and we're building more military bases. That takes a lot of money,
yep.
And we don't have it in savings.
Precisely. Yeah, I think inflating our way out of this from the standpoint of the dollar means that you have to convince somebody to take those worthless dollars. And that, as I pointed out earlier, the dollars in circulation worldwide have grown by 2,500% up until 2000. Probably if we had up-to-date data on that, I don't have them at the moment. It's way over a 3,000% increase by now. It's going exponential. I mean, these are hyperbolic curves that we're looking at in every single area. The federal debt, the total debt of the system, point out up to $40 trillion now. The housing mortgage debt, that's just an accident waiting to happen. I have a very good friend in Arizona who's in one of the hottest real estate construction areas in the country, and he said it's just madness. People are, flipping homes almost one a week here to double and triple their paper profits. And that when a bubble gets into that phase, you know that it's going to end in tears. So what will be the political response to that from Washington? That's a little bit of a worrisome question that some people have as well. People start getting a little bit angry at what happened to their life savings, not just the Enron phenomenon, but that on a orders of magnitude larger scale.
I want to bring something that is also another element that can make this very interesting, and that is peak oil. The oil crisis of the 70s, to me, was a demand meeting up with supply constraints and also a political crisis more than it was a geological crisis.
Right.
What we're seeing now is, once again, demand has met up with supply. Even if we could get the oil, we don't have the refineries to turn that into usable products.
Yeah.
We've hit maximum capacity. How does peak oil play into this? And I guess maybe a secondary question, if we're building bases all over the Middle East, controlling the pipelines, controlling the source of oil, does that give us a better position, or does this really bring about World War III?
Well, the last point you make, Jim, is really the one that concerns me. I think Washington and certainly the group of hawks in the Pentagon who are dominating policy and now certainly in the White House, they have a very, very strong policy sway since the present president has been in Washington. They seem simply not to care. They think that their power projections or their full-spectrum dominance means that, well, they even say openly, why beat around the bush? America is an empire, and we should be proud of it and boast of it, and the rest of the world can take it on the ear if they don't like it. That kind of arrogance is not only damaging, but it's the height of folly. Whom the gods would make mad, they first destroy, is the old Greek saying. But this question of the peaking of oil, I think if you look around to the major oil sources worldwide in the last 40, 50 years, you have in Alaska, the Prudhoe Bay has peaked some years now and is on its depletion downslide of the bell-shaped curve, the famous King Hubbard bell-shaped curve of the peak of the optimal production. The North Sea has peaked. This has become something in the year 2000, the British North Sea peaked, and now the rate of that decline has begun accelerating in a dramatic way, such that the British are finally waking up. The British government openly is talking about a post-petroleum era for Britain. Well, for 35 years, since the beginning of the 70s, well, actually since 1973 and the first oil shock when North Sea oil became financially attractive at a higher oil price, Britain has lived off of the sterling, has been a petrocurrency. Well, that era is gone. The big fields like Brent, you know, Brent is one of the markers, ironically, of crude oil prices today. Well, it shouldn't be, because the Brent field is down to something, last time I looked, around 10,000 barrels a day. It's a disappearing field, which has been relegated to tiny independent companies because big companies no longer find it economical. The real question, which I think one of your guests, Matt Simmons, whom I talked with Berlin last year about this, Matthew Simmons, speculates based on all the best information he's able to glean from petroleum sources in and around Saudi Arabia, is that the Ghawar field, the giant, the mother of all oil production fields, with something like 5.5, almost 6 million barrels a day.
5 million barrels a day, that's almost half of Saudi oil production. If that goes into decline, world oil, peak oil, has been reached.
Yeah, that is the big question. And Simmons and some other people and some geologists, Colin Campbell from Scotland, called the Saudis bluff, when was it, about a year or two ago in the summer. And the Saudis rushed people over to Washington to hold a press conference and vehemently deny, with very shaky data, that their oil had in fact peaked. But I think all the indication of the water injection into Ghawar, millions of barrels of salt water a day, indicates that they are in a desperate situation there. So Saudi, the major fields, the condition in the Russian oil fields, as best anyone can tell, and the geologists that I've spoken with and the Western European oilmen who've been to Russia, is that they are dangerously overproducing most of their big oil fields in Russia to get maximum currency, you know, dollar flows into the economy after 1998. And unless they get some huge new investment and infrastructure built up there, they're gonna be in trouble in terms of maintaining the oil flows in 2 to 3 years. And even the Russian press talks about this danger. So if you take that and compare that with the demand side of the equation, you have this enormous, what do you call it, 800-pound oil gorilla, or I don't know what an appropriate term is. That's probably not the best term to refer to China. But China has gone from a zero factor of demand on the international oil import markets 10 years ago, 1994. China was a net exporter of oil. Last year, China became the second largest importer behind the United States. It surpassed Japan of crude oil, and over the next few years, the demand of Asia for oil is expected to double to 40 million barrels a day. So that you have this huge exponential demand curve going coming out of Asian economic growth. The Chinese, of course, are scrambling all over the world right now to get secure energy pipelines or energy resources for its future economic growth, because that they realize is their Achilles heel. And the United States is moving just as quickly to cut them off from that oil. So this, I think, is the number one hidden geopolitical game in the world today, this contest for oil between oil control between China and Washington.
Aren't we following a similar pattern when we cut off oil to the Japanese?
You mean in the eve to Pearl Harbor?
Correct. I mean, we may be announcing here domestically that we're closing down bases, but we're building them all over throughout the oil belt.
Yeah. Well, I think that's precisely the kind of thing that if Washington is preempting the Chinese, for example, one of the hidden aspects of the entire human rights hue and cry in Washington in the last couple of years over South Sudan has very little to do, in my estimation, with the rights of Christian over and above the Islamic government in Khartoum. It has to do with the fact that the South Sudan is a huge reserve of oil, and 7% of Chinese daily oil consumption comes by Chinese-built pipelines going from southern Sudan to a special port in central Sudan, and by ship, by tankers, on to China. So when the U.S. starts making a human rights campaign over southern Sudan, that signals in Beijing that the U.S. is trying to cut off a major flow of Chinese energy security. The same thing has happened in Iraq. Iraq was really, according to everything I've been able to determine from the Chinese side, Iraq was the wake-up call to the Chinese, who thought they had perhaps another 10 years of economic growth financed by American corporations coming there for cheap labor and so forth, outsourcing of production and whatnot, the Walmart phenomenon. They thought they had about 10 years more of that before the United States would turn on China as a major rival, geopolitical rival. The Iraq war signaled in Beijing that, no, we don't have 10 years more. It is now, and we have to secure our energy supply lines now and urgently. They've been going, they've been trying to do that with Venezuela. They've been doing it in Brazil. They've done it with Iran. One of the highly interesting aspects about the choice of Iran is one of the axis of evil countries together with Iraq. And not to forget, there were three countries who had major contracts, signed contract with the previous government in Iraq of Saddam Hussein. One of them was China, one of them was Russia, and one of them was France. Yeah, all three of them opposed, of course, the U.S. war in Iraq. So that's a very dangerous course when a nation feels every economic resource line is being systematically cut off. That can lead to consequences that are very, very dangerous for the world, not only world peace, but also for the United States, despite the relative military dominance of Washington right now. As the Chinese know very well, there are many forms of warfare.
And especially when you have foreign governments now controlling almost half our debt. You know, one thing that kind of strikes me, and this is something that if you read Simmons's book, Twilight in the Desert, he refers to that at some point, if we wake up one day and we find out that production in Garwar has peaked, that Russian production has peaked, so that now we're on an energy diet, how do you create a system that can allocate resources and put everybody on a diet and do so without conflict.
Well, I think Michael Clare and others call this, we're entering an era of resource wars, or we're in an era of resource wars, and I think that's very accurate in many respects.
As you look forward in history, having studied what happened to the British Empire and looking at the American Empire walking down the same road, I don't see, I guess looking at this in the future, how this ends well.
Well, I'm an optimist by constitution. It's one of the solid things that that we Americans are born with, I guess. But I have to say that this one really poses paradoxes and dilemmas that I can't see a peaceful resolution of, short of a dramatic revolution in thinking in the United States itself. And perhaps this mother, Cindy Sheehan, I've been following this with great interest, but if I can take an apparent diversion, it's not really. But when she decided to come down to Crawford, Texas, and pitch her tent outside of the Bush family ranch and say, "I want an eyeball-to-eyeball answer from you, Mr. President. Why did my son die in Iraq if you lied about the reasons for going to war? What was the reason? You have to tell me what was so important that it cost my son's life and thousands of other American sons and daughters." And what this little demonstration, which 2-3 years ago would have been completely ignored, it seems to me it set off kind of a brush fire of sentiment among ordinary Americans that are beginning to realize, wait a minute, if the President of the United States lies about the reason we're in Iraq, there are no weapons of mass destruction. If people like Paul Wolfowitz arrogantly say, the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, who's now the head of the World Bank, that we simply used the excuse of WMD as a convenient rallying point to convince the Americans to back the war, Richard Pearl and others of the hawkish stripe have said the same thing. Ordinary Americans are beginning to say, wait a minute, this is not my government. This is not a representative system that we're talking about when we're lied to on this level systematically and repeatedly. Wait a minute here, ladies and gentlemen, what is going on? If that kind of reaction begins to get traction, and there's some indications that it is, if you look at the opinion polls, then we might have a real open debate about where did the country go off the tracks economically, where did we get off the tracks politically, many other areas. But short of that, if my fellow Americans continue to sit there glued to the television passively or video games or whatever and just passively watch this happen, then it's a very pessimistic perspective. But that, you know, simply will have to see in the play out of time.
As you stand here in summary, taking a look at how things are playing out right now with peak oil somewhere near or close by, are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Jim, that's an unfair question at this moment. I really, to say I just take each day as it comes. There's so many potential ways that the situation could develop. I think we're coming into the most dangerous period in world history, bar none, simply because the scale-up effect of total spectrum dominance, the Pentagon's force projection, is such that it it threatens biological holocaust, it threatens nuclear holocaust, it threatens chemical catastrophe and every which thing you can imagine. So, the stakes of serious mistakes are greater than they ever were before. But it's also a period where great surprises can take place. So I would hope for the latter, and let's pray that it works out, that we see that. I might, if I can put in a plug for it, tell readers, or listeners rather, that they can find, in addition to the book, The Century of War, they can find, which is available over Amazon.com or the various online booksellers, I have a website, www.engdahl.com. oilgeopolitics.net if any of your listeners want to follow some of my thinking on various of the recent developments in Eurasia with the oil geopolitics, as well as some of the historical developments, they're welcome to look.
All right. Well, Mr. Engdahl, I want to thank you for joining us on the Financial Sense News Hour. Your book gives a great and important historical perspective on the oil situation. We've been discussing peak oil here for several years. In fact, I've written about it 4 or 5 years ago. But I think you've added a political dimension that gives some insight into it. So why don't you give out your website again so people can follow in terms of updates on this?
Okay. It's www.engdahl, E-N-G-D-A-H-L, and then ., oilgeopolitics, O-I-L-G-E-O-P-O-L-I-T-I-C-S, .net. Engdahl.oilgeopolitics.net.
All right, Mr. Engdahl, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. The name of the book is called A Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order. Mr. Engdahl, I want to wish you all the best and hope to talk to you again in the future.
Jim, thank you very much, and I enjoyed it thoroughly.